Dr. Gina Borecka, author of It's Not That I'm Bitter, How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Visible Panty Lines and Conquered the World, has appeared on 2020, The Today Show, CNN, BBC, NPR, and many other media outlets to discuss gender, power, politics, and humor. Her earlier books included the best-selling They Used to Call Me Snow White, But I Drifted, Women's Strategic Use of Humor. She'll be the keynote speaker at a fundraiser for Zonda Club of Northampton, Massachusetts, on Thursday. Gina Borecka is here to give us a preview this morning. Welcome to the program. Thank you very much for taking the time out. I appreciate it.
Oh, I'm absolutely delighted to talk to you. This is terrific.
Well, it is terrific. So how did this, when you go to a group like this, what is the message you like to dispense?
Well, I like to think of it as sort of bringing the pajama party with me. It's really, first of all, the Zonda Club is, you know, one of those organizations that really does good sort of all over the world. They've been around for a very long time, and their mission is to help the lives of women and girls around the globe. And they've been very effective at doing that. And I'm really happy to be able to help them celebrate everything that they do by bringing humor to it. I think that one of the most effective ways that women can make our voices heard is to have a good time while doing it. And I talk about humor. That's what I've been writing about for the last 25 years. And I really do think that if you put three women together for more than 13 seconds, we actually start to laugh. Even when we're talking about serious subjects, you know, that's why there is always laughter coming out of the ladies' room. And you'll have noticed, I bet, that there is rarely laughter coming out of the men's room.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, and actually when there is, we should worry. You know?
So
you guys don't have separate stalls. It's a whole different world in there.
So let me ask you the question. How much of that is initiated and how much of that is response when it comes to laughter?
Oh, I think that it's both. I think that with women, the stereotype, and this is what, when I first wrote They Used to Call Me Snow White, But I Drifted, which actually wonderfully has just been released in a classic edition by the University Press of New England. 25 years, some of what's gone on in women's humor has changed, some hasn't, and it's been interesting to sort of map what has been different and what's remained sort of in place. But I was trying to figure out, why is it that I'm surrounded by these laughing women, and yet there is this fundamental cultural stereotype that women have no sense of humor, that women are the ones going around going, that's not nice, that's not funny, don't say something like that, that's, I'm very sensitive. And I thought, but I'm surrounded by these laughing broads, so where's the gap? And I think that part of it is because women were always taught, not taught, not like as in a lesson plan with somebody with, you know, an overhead projector and a pointer, but we absorb from the culture that having a sense of humor meant you were supposed to laugh at somebody else's jokes, right? Like
right.
The guy's jokes. And that once we start, you know, getting a little more nervy and shameless and powerful, which often comes with growing up, I have to say, with getting older, we learn to laugh out loud more at the stuff we find funny. And that's been the fun part of looking at women's humor and the differences between men and women's humor.
And when you talk about those differences, because it seems to me, in whether it be male or female, that there is that person at the center when you have three or four people around who is sort of providing the content and the other people are doing the color, if you will. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that more, I would argue, we could get into an interesting debate about this. I would argue that that's truer, in fact, of a male-dominated group, even a mixed group, I would say. There'll still be some guy who's like a wag, a wit at the center of it.
Yeah.
When women are really laughing together, men, in a way, men don't understand this, because when women say, I got something funny to tell you, they're not going to tell you a joke. They're going to explain something funny that happened to them, like driving into where they were.
Yeah.
And so when a woman says, I got something funny to tell you, if you're smart, you'll sit down. because you're going to be there a long, long time. And other women are going to come up and they're going to start saying, oh, God, when I was driving, I also decided to get a cup of coffee. But you know what I do? I put in half caffeinated, half decaf. Some other woman's coming over going, you know what you do? You do half caf, half decaf, half 2% milk, half, half, and half. And other women are coming over talking about green tea. And it spins off into this bizarre thing where everybody's laughing. And in fact, nobody, there isn't one thread that's going on. And the poor guy who's standing there, who had been expecting to hear something funny, you know, he's baffled by this whole thing.
But it still strikes me, is even if it's five, six, seven women, that there is that it is a personality thing, right? I mean, there are people who engage and have that personality, who are able to like yourself, who are able to capture an audience and to talk and make other people comfortable enough to share. But there's always sort of that one person who is, you know, for want of a better term, a hoot.
I do like the idea of a hoot. It is one of my favorite words.
Yes.
It's interesting that you use that. I do love the idea of having a hoot. I really believe that what keeps people from being able to find the laughter in their own life is sort of the internal censor. And what I try to do in my books and in the talks that I give is to help people sort of find out what that voice is that's telling them, oh, just stop, you're going to make a fool of yourself. Oh, don't, you know, somebody's you're going to offend somebody.
Yeah.
That to remove the governor, like the governor on a motor that stops you from going over a certain mile per hour, to remove that governor, to remove that veil, to take that gag off your mouth. I mean, the word gag is interesting because it's the joke itself, but it's also something put over your mouth so that you shut up. And I think that, you know, different groups have been gagged in our culture. Usually the groups that don't have, that are marginalized, that don't have a lot of power. And so removing that gag becomes sort of a mission for me to help people find that. Because once people start laughing and they realize that, like, they have permission to become that person, that everybody can be at the center of that group, or that the group itself can be so diverse and so large that there doesn't have to be just one center, that they can engage in it themselves, it's a wonderful form of experience that people come to, that they can be more than observers at it. You know, they can be more than cheerleaders. They can actually play. And I think that finally the best humor really is about play. And that's the part where you let everybody in.
And once you let everybody in and you have that, as you call it, play, but then the true power comes in being able to do something, if that is the nature of the moment, do something substantive with it. Because you have gained that confidence and control and power.
That really is. I like to think that, I think it was Carol Leifer, who's a great stand-up comic.
Wonderful
and
who writer.
Said that the best who stand up for something. That the comics, you know, from Aristophanes onwards. I mean, my day job is as a professor at the University of Connecticut. And, you know, the best comic work, you know, whether it's done under a proscenium arch or done, you know, in the back of a nightclub or in a book, is stuff that translates the world so uniquely that the world never returns to the place that it was before it was transformed comically. That it really does, it messes stuff up. You don't see it the same way again. It's as transformative as tragedy. It makes you look at something from an entirely new perspective. And when you really, if you go back to the idea of comedy as carnival and all the rest of it, that it not only lets off steam in the way that Freud talked about it, but it also sometimes inverts the world permanently. Once you mock something, if you mock it well enough, there's always that other sort of shadow around it, so that it never quite goes back to being two-dimensional. There's always this third dimension to it, and that's really magic. That's really absolutely wonderful. So the best comedy you know, again, when they stand up for something. The best comedy has something that you take away from it. There's a larger message to it. And when I go to do, you know, the work that we're going to be doing at the Zonta Club on May 2nd, on Thursday night in Northampton, it's really about coming together. I mean, laughing together is such a fabulous experience. It's something that really does get better when you're doing it with other people. There are some things I hear that are like that. But it also, you come away feeling like the world is much more your home after you've laughed with other people. It is the most reassuring and yet sort of seditious, subversive activity that you can do in a group.
It's so universal. Why do we consider it subversive, do you think?
Oh, because if you're taking really good ideas, and let's say you're looking at, for example, how people are marginalized, why certain injustices still exist in the world. If we're looking at the hard issue, which is, again, what good humor always does, not the ice cream, but the laughter,
right.
That you're looking at humor as a way to talk about what's taboo. Great humor deals with the toughest issues in the world. Really good humor deals with religion, politics, sex, fashion, you know, stuff that's too scary to talk about in other places. And again, pushes it to the most extreme limit so that we can think about it in ways that are a little bit unsafe, but we think about it then, you know, it's sort of shining the light on something. I mean, it really is. It's putting the spotlight on issues that that are often sort of kept in the back of the room. And I think especially for women, just to know that, you know, we're not alone and we're not nuts. Those are the two most basic issues that we're dealing with. So that when you've got somebody up there who's talking about the ways women's lives are represented, just to discover that you have much more in common than we would sometimes imagine from, you know, reading about women's lives that, you know, if celebrities of people who are out there in, you know, in the news, and we think, oh God, I don't look like that, I don't act like that, I don't cook like that, I don't sing like that, I don't behave that way, and then you talk to regular people and you find out that all the rest of us have all the, you know, the details of our lives in common. It's wonderfully reassuring.
So then when we leave and the group leaves on Thursday night, you hope they take what with them to be able to employ in their daily lives?
Oh, a greater sense of, first of all, just how wonderful humor can be in everybody's daily life, and that most humor is found humor. You don't need to make anything up. You don't need to tell jokes. You don't need to memorize things. Women don't tell jokes. We, in fact, ruin jokes for others, right? We would go up to perfectly nice men that we know and say, Harry, tell that one about the shrimp. And Harry will go, I can never tell that joke again. Shrimp is the punchline, right? Women don't tell jokes. But if you just pay attention in life, life gives us the funny stuff. All you need to do is look around. So that to see what's funny, to remind yourself what a riot life is, to be able to mock the absurdities of life and turn them into something that's a funny story, because as we all know, pain plus time equals humor. And once you make that funny story out of something in your life that's been bothering you, that's been gnawing at you, that's been nagging at you, or something in the world that does that, it becomes yours, and you can then do what you want with it. It redeems moments. So I see humor as an act of redemption. And I'd like everybody to come out feeling a lot better than they went in and a lot more powerful than when they went in.
Can it reinforce stereotypes? Because you're looking for common ground, so you'll say something and you'll say, you know, women don't do this or men do this. And I mean, is that through that stereotyping a feeling or a group, is can that be overcome and understood then?
Well,
or does it become further entrenched?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think that I am, you know, the queen of generalizations. Life is short. You know, if I've got 40 minutes to talk about something, I'm not going to go into, let's say, the distinction between sex and gender as I might in a 17-week class at the university, because I got 40 minutes and people are doing, downing Chardonnay like it's the end of the world. So I'm going to try to make a different kind of point within a short space of time in memorable stories that people are going to be able to take away with them. And I think that you can reduce without misrepresenting, patterns in life, with the understanding that, of course, Mister, this doesn't apply to you, but most people feel this way, and I think that again might be reductive, but not misrepresentative.
It's Thursday, May 2nd. The Zonta Club of Northampton will have their benefit. You can find out more information about Gina and the event by going to Gina's website. It's Gina Barreca, B-A-R-R-E-C-A. G-I-N-A, so it's G-I-N-A-B-A-R-R-E-C-A.com, GinaBarreca.com, and find out more about the event Thursday night at the Clarion Hotel in Northampton, Massachusetts, and I think it runs 5:30 to 7:30, and again, you can find out more information at GinaBarreca.com. Gina, thank you very much for being with us, and good to have you in the region.
Thank you so much. I hope I'll talk to you again.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Snow Farm, Williamsburg, a New England craft program offering creative arts workshops taught by master craftspeople for adults and teens, beginners and up, snowfarm.org. And the museum at Bethel Woods with a Rolling Stone magazine photography exhibit on assignment Woodstock, now through August 18th, bethelwoodscenter.org/museum.
Making it through the frigid winter in the Finger Lakes region of Naples, New York, is viewed by many locals as an accomplishment. With spring's arrival comes nature's renewal. It's also when the wood thrush returns to Pulse of the Planet listeners DJ and Cami Kitzel's neighborhood. I'm Jim Metzner, and this is the Pulse of the Planet. The first time DJ heard the thrush was when he opened the window above his newborn son's bed. Since then, it's become a yearly reminder.
The wood thrush connects me to the birth of my son, the wonder, the stress, the sleepless nights, the excitement. And although the thrush returning is predictable, it's nonetheless surprising when it shows up. It's a renewal.
For Cami Kitzel, the thrush's singing is an annual reconnection to the family's home and its woodland community.
Well, and when we moved here, it was just a two-room little cabin. The woods were very overgrown, and we saw it as a place of possibilities, and we knew we'd do it all ourselves. So every year, we get a piece of that possible dream done. So when the snow melts and we look out, we never forget to stop and say, wow, look at how this place has changed since we moved here. It's so beautiful. And so every year when the kind of the outdoor work season begins, I know we're going to get another big piece of that work done. Yeah. And next spring we'll look out and things will be different again.
Yep. And hearing the thrush is like a touchstone to that.
To hear about our new CD, please visit pulseplanet.com. Pulse of the Planet is made possible by the National Science Foundation. I'm Jim Metzner.
Support for WAMC comes from the Gideon Putnam Resort. Featuring on-site dining, the Roosevelt Baths and Spa, summer packages and more, GideonPutnam.com. And unusual wedding rings and more in Crawford Square, North Street, downtown Pittsfield. Specializing in wedding and engagement rings with a variety of jewelry for special occasions or everyday wear. UnusualWeddingRings.com.
Hi, this is Alan. You know what? We love you and we need you. Yeah, we love you and we need you as volunteers in the great Schlep Forward the Next WAMC Fund Drive. This time you call Michelle Battle. That's M Battle, as in, battle, at WAMC.org. June 3rd is the start date, 1-800-323-9262, extension 189. Let me repeat, we need you. Thank you.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jean Cochran. Stocks on Wall Street are getting a boost this morning from a couple of encouraging economic reports. Wages and spending rose in March. NPR's Dave Mattingly reports the numbers suggest higher taxes have not held back consumers.
Economist Hugh Johnson says with job growth slowing in March, he expected consumer spending to be flat. But the Commerce Department reports spending and incomes rose 0.2%.
We expected a little bit softer number. It came in not very strong, but nevertheless a little better than expected. It's still a pretty somewhat positive but weak number.
Analysts say it appears higher incomes, along with falling gasoline prices, helped to offset higher Social Security taxes that kicked in on January 1st. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
And checking Wall Street, the Dow's up 70 points, the Nasdaq up 27, the broader S&P 500 is up 9. First quarter profits at Chrysler tumbled 65%, with shipments of cars and trucks down. Chrysler, which is majority owned by Italy's Fiat, is preparing to launch several key new vehicles. The losses in the first quarter add up to $108 million. The parents of the Boston bombing suspects say they've put off the idea of any trip to the United States for now. NPR's Corey Flintoff has more from Moscow.
The Reuters news agency quotes an interview with the suspect's father, Anzor Tsarnaev, in which he says that he's changed his mind about traveling to the United States. The father told reporters just last week that he intended to make the trip to seek justice for his surviving son, Jahar, and to bury his eldest son, Tamerlan. The suspect's parents have insisted that their sons were not involved in Islamist extremism and that they were framed for the bombing. The father said he was ill with high blood pressure and heart problems and could not make the trip to the U.S. The mother, Zubidat Tsarnaeva, said previously that she didn't intend to make the trip. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Moscow.
6 months after the deadly superstorm Sandy, and federal approval is expected today for plans to rebuild. New York Senator Charles Schumer speaking on MSNBC.
The first $1.7 billion, a majority of which should go to housing, is coming to New York City. Another $1.7 billion for New York State, and then money in New Jersey. And this is what they need. So now they have a green light to begin rebuilding.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says President Obama has kept every promise he's made about helping the state recover. Also speaking on MSNBC, Christie says presidential politics was the last thing on his mind as he toured storm-devastated areas with President Obama last fall. Christie has angered some Republicans who said that it helped tip a close election away from Mitt Romney. Again, checking Wall Street, the Dow is up by 72 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org.
Our tune for today is Sophisticated Lady by Duke Ellington from his album Live at the Blue Note, recorded at the Blue Note nightclub in Chicago and first released in 1959. Duke Ellington was born April 29, 1899 in Washington, D.C. Today would have been his 114th birthday. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from MPAC, presenting Software Archaeology on the resurrection of programs for the Mark I, 1948-1958, a talk by media archaeologist and artist David Link, Wednesday, May 1st at 6 p.m., mpac.rpi.edu. And the Preservation League of New York State, Albany, protecting New York's historic buildings, districts, and landscapes since 1974, preservenys.org.
Manil Suri's new novel, The City of Devi, opens with India and Pakistan on the verge of nuclear war. India is roiled by factional violence between Hindus and Muslims. Bombers strafe citizens, vigilantes settle scores, and terrorists set off dirty bombs around the country as Mumbai boils over with fear and fury. At the heart of the novel is a love story, a humor story, and an adventure story. The City of Devi is Suri's third novel in a series that's roughly based on the Hindu Trinity. Suri was born in Mumbai and is now a professor of mathematics at the University of Maryland. In this book show preview, Suri explains what brought him to these stories.
Well, it sort of appeared after I finished the first book, which was The Death of Vishnu. And even that book, it was based on an actual person named Vishnu, and I didn't really think about the Hindu god originally, but when that connection was made, I started looking into these things. And then with the second book, it was Shiva. You know, it was like, okay, now write a book about Shiva, knowing only this one word, Shiva. It's like a homework assignment. And then with this third book, the traditional Trinity is actually Vishnu the preserver, Shiva the destroyer, and Brahma the creator. But somehow in the middle of this book, when I saw all this destruction and possibly saving the city, it had to be the mother goddess who has all these different kinds of incarnations. So that's why it became the City of Devi.
And to let the listener know, these can certainly be read in any order. It is, I read them out of order. It doesn't matter.
No, they're all unrelated in that sense. They only form a loose trilogy in the sense that they give you the past, present, and future of the city of Mumbai. So this is the future part.
This is a book that certainly in the background, in the surroundings of what is going on, well, in the forefront and in the background, is great violence and great turmoil. And you set that up to a sense of, here we are, India and Pakistan on the verge of nuclear war. It's a scary time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it is a scary time. And, you know, that's the background, as you said. And I guess my own sense is that India, when it's faced with such situations, people react in very strange ways. I mean, it's more a sense of the absurd, the surreal. I think what comes to mind is something like the movie Doctor Strangelove, where, you know, there's all this disaster that's about to happen and people are worried about collecting cell phones, for instance, in this book.
Mm. So you think to yourself as you read this, what's a nice mathematics professor writing a novel like this that is so dark? And then at the center, we read about this woman, Sarita, who is a statistician. She is a young woman who has just graduated with a degree in statistics, and we're off to the races.
Yeah, I figured that, okay, it was time to write a character that actually had some sort of mathematical background. I didn't want to go that far, push the public too much, so I didn't choose a mathematician. Figured a statistician would be more acceptable.
Close enough. Yeah. And were you allowed to employ a little of that knowledge within that character? It seems as though.
Yeah, very little, though. And it's interesting because one of the readers who read it first said that she really liked the little touches of Sarita being a statistician. So later on in the novel, you know, she finds little mistakes in what another character has done in terms of this horrendous death toll. And she finds a mistake in the decimal point and says that it's a little better than that. So, you know, it's typically what a math type person would do.
Tell us a little bit about Sarita, of the creation of this character, of how you came to her as really the center point.
Well, it started with her being someone who was not completely sure of her own attractiveness. I wanted to create a character that, you know, was a little gawky almost. And even though it is a stereotype, I guess, you know, using that kind of math nerd type thing, which I guess people would accuse me of too in a part of my life. So that was very interesting to play with. And so her husband has disappeared, and she really has to find him in the midst of all this chaos. And I think what I liked about her was that since she's so unsure about herself, when she does marry Karun, she really invests all her chances of happiness in him. So it's essential that she find him.
And Karun is interesting because there's that mystery. We don't know. We don't know a tremendous amount about him then.
Yeah, he's been kind of wavering in many ways. He's sort of very internalized. He's someone that you don't get to know right away. You have to kind of peel away the layers of his character, much like an onion. And, you know, you just see right at the end, even the reader only finds out at the end, what he's really made up of.
And then there is, in this triumvirate, there is Jazz. And Jazz is one of the great characters that I've read in contemporary fiction. This character is a hoot.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I just had so much fun writing him. Jazz is this gay Muslim character, and he's completely irreverent. He's sort of found himself through his own sexuality. And so he has a romp in the book. He's, you know, always having sex, and he's very open about it. And he likes to speak in one-liners. So once I actually got his character down, he sort of just came to me, you know, more or less, here is Jazz speaking. And at one point, I was even going to start tweeting as him, but I never got that far.
What do you think those tweets would be like?
Oh, I don't know. I might still do it. So you know, stay tuned.
And what's interesting is because you have that type of character, the other two characters who are going through so much and so much turmoil almost become the calm in the storm, if you will.
Yeah, I think Jazz is great because, and Sarita is useful too, because she plays off. She's the kind of straight guy to Jazz's comedy. And so, you know, Jazz has this kind of almost like a bad boy image. So we're all naturally attracted to someone like that. And that's why you find that, and the novel is actually told in alternating viewpoints. So that kind of helps the pace, because the pace was something I really wanted to keep you know, really taught in this novel. It was something I paid the most attention to. So having Jazz and Sarita alternate, it kind of pulls the reader along.
I was going to ask you about that because I used the word adventure in my introduction because there is that page-turner quality to the book as well of a very fast pace because of those multiple voices and also because of the action and the characters.
Yeah, I just decided that with this book, I wanted to really create something that, you know, sometimes you sort of concentrate on character. Sometimes you concentrate on language. Here, I'm interested in all of those, but I decided to put pace as number one. And so I did have that idea of creating an adventure. And you kind of have to go along with the flow. There are trains that go off tracks. There are elephants that come to the rescue. There are saris that glow in the dark. You have to kind of accept all this and sort of trust me and come along with it.
And what impressed me is with that fast pace, there is such a sense of intimacy and a portrait of love and young love and that uncertainty that you allow us, the reader, to learn about. So you take your time when you have to.
Yeah, and I think that's what the structure again allowed me to do, because the way it's set up is when Saritha is narrating her part of the novel, it's in the present and she's in the midst of all this chaos and everything, and then she's having flashbacks to the past, and those are the more serene, kind of slower chunks of the novel. And that's the same with Jazz too, because he is also reminiscing about his past love.
And she is 31 years old, has come close to being married before, and has never quite gotten there.
Right. And that's what makes her, as I said, you know, someone who's really invested in Karun, who is this first suitor who has actually, you know, she's had success with him.
We are talking to Manil Suri about his new novel, The City of Devi. It is published by Norton. Writing about Mumbai, what is that experience like for you, writing about home?
It's been changing through the three novels. I think in the first novel, it was everything that you knew about, you know, growing up, all your memories and everything, all the juice that writers come with, that all gets expended in that first novel. So in the second novel, which was about the past of Mumbai, you know, once you have used up everything that you have, like any good writer, you start stealing from your parents. So I sort of, you know, looked at their story and took little tidbits from that. And so with this novel, I really had nothing left. So the only thing to do was to sort of destroy Mumbai. And maybe that's one way to stop writing about it, too. But what was really interesting was going to the city and tracing out the same path that these characters take from the south part to the north part, actually walking that entire distance myself and looking for things, for scenarios, for scenes that I could then use in the book and sort of blow up, you know, like a kid kind of blowing up a toy city. So that was very interesting.
Manil Suri's latest is The City of Devi. It's published by Norton. You can hear the complete book show Tuesday afternoons at 3, Thursday evenings at 8:30, or anytime online at wamc.org.
Support for WAMC comes from Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center, Poughkeepsie, a master's in social work program now offering a postgraduate certified alcohol substance abuse counselor trainee class beginning May 13th, socialwork.adelphi.edu/CONTED. And New York Electric Motor Service, Glens Falls, New York, specializing in electrical and mechanical apparatus sales and service, a subsidiary of Applied Dynamics, NewYorkElectricMotorService.com.
In 2006, Time magazine cited Bright Lights, Big City as one of nine generation-defining novels of the 20th century. Jay McInerney is a novelist, but he is also a wine columnist for Wall Street Journal and a regular contributor to The Guardian, as well as having his fiction appear in The New Yorker, Esquire, and Playboy. There is a new collection of his wine writing out entitled The Juice. It is published by Vintage, and it's a pleasure to welcome Jay McInerney to the roundtable this morning. What brought you to this particular subject? The essays on wine have, you've been doing this for quite a while. What brought you to collect them?
Well, this is actually my third collection of essays on wine. Back in 1996, my friend Dominique Browning took over the editorship of House and Garden magazine, and she decided that the time was ripe for a wine column in that magazine, that people who appreciated the good life were probably into wine. And she knew, as a friend of mine, that I was fairly passionate about wine, and she called and asked me if I'd consider writing a column, and my first reaction was that I wasn't an expert, I was just an enthusiast, but she felt that that was just what she wanted. Her feeling was that wine writing then was kind of very boring or very technical, and that was actually true. So she encouraged me to just write from an enthusiast's and a novelist's point of view, basically, and didn't know much about malolactic fermentation, but I knew when I loved a wine, and I knew that the people who made the wine were inevitably interesting characters, and writing about interesting characters is something I'd been doing for quite a while.
So when it comes to this subject, and as you mentioned, this is your third collection of essays, what is there that keeps bringing you back? I mean, obviously, it's a complex subject that allows you to explore it in so many different ways.
Well, you know, it really is. I mean, it's kind of an endless subject. You know, you can approach wine from the point of view of an incredibly long history that goes back pretty much to, you know, recorded human history. You can approach it from a geological, a meteorological, a cultural point of view, from the point of view of the art and literature it's inspired from, the botanical point of view, if you will. I mean, as I say, in my case, I'm especially interested in sort of bringing the experience alive for people by telling the stories of the people who make the wines, the places they come from, the adventures that I have in searching them out. And the farther I go, the more interested I get, really. I think when I started out, my tastes were different, and I keep discovering new wines, and I think my palate probably changes over time.
Do you still think of yourself as an enthusiast?
Well, you know, I've been at this for a while now. I moved from House and Garden to the Wall Street Journal a few years ago, and I've visited some of the most interesting and prominent wine regions in the world and met a lot of the world's winemakers. So I guess at this point, I would be hard-pressed to say that I'm an amateur, but at the same time, I mean, it's still kind of my it's my avocation, and it's my hobby more than it is my day job, and I still, I don't know, I just still have a lot of enthusiasm for the subject. You know, I always said to myself, as soon as it stops being fun, I'll stop doing it, because, you know, I have another job as a novelist and a screenwriter and a journalist, but somehow it's never stopped being fun.
When you think of this world, obviously what you write for Wall Street Journal or that you've written for other publications certainly are general interest, but I would imagine you learn how wide and varied this world of wine enthusiasts is.
Well, the trick is to, you know, in my case, because I do write for general interest publications, and because I'm trying to write for non-specialists, is, you know, you have to remember to talk to the people who don't read a lot of wine publications and don't spend a lot of time in damp wine cellars. And you have to remember not to fall into the jargon that the insiders use, and to leave the you know, the general wine enthusiast behind. You know, and I've always tried to just work with my own vocabulary. I mean, I'd much rather compare a wine to a fashion model or an automobile than I would to a flower. You know, a lot of wine writing when I started out was what I called the horticultural school of wine writing. You know, wines smelled like May blossoms and honeysuckle, and honestly, I don't know anything about flowers. So I thought metaphor, you know, I think metaphor is a much better way to go at the subject. I mean, you know, if I compare a California Chardonnay to Pamela Anderson, most people have a pretty good idea of what I'm trying to get at. You know, the idea that California Chardonnays are very fleshy and ripe, and you know, most people kind of get that right away.
You have a lot of literary references as well.
Well, yeah, I guess that's inevitable. That's my that's my primary field of reference. But you know, I try to leaven it with a lot of pop culture as well.
Pop culture and humor, and I think it's safe to say that. It can often be, wine writing can often be stuffy, and you're far removed from that.
It can be very stuffy, and I think that, you know, until recently, wine culture, wine appreciation just seemed daunting to the average American. You know, I'm happy to say that that's certainly much less true now than it was, you know, when I started trying to learn about wine. It was much harder to learn about wine, and also, you know, there was this, I don't know, there was this very cliquish culture, and there was a kind of a class association. You know, real men didn't drink wine; they drank beer or whiskey. I think that's changed very rapidly. You know, wine appreciation has really grown alongside the appreciation of food and the food culture in this country. You know, think about the way that we were eating 30 years ago,
right,
as opposed to the way we're eating now. About the fact that there was no such thing as a celebrity chef, and I think that wine has wine appreciation has progressed along with that, with food and restaurant culture.
It's a delightful new collection of wine writing. It is The Juice. It is published by Vintage. Jay McInerney, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is The Juice. It is published by Vintage. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Thanks so much for being with us this morning. We'll be back tomorrow with our Roundtable panel featuring Mike Spain of the Times Union. Plus, we'll get our book picks for the week from our friends at Oblong Books and Music in Rhinebeck and Millerton. We'll talk with journalist David Rode about his new book, Beyond War, Reimagining American Influence in a New Middle East. And Alan Chartok will be back in the Congressional Corner, plus much more. Do hope you'll join us tomorrow. My thanks go to our entire team. Sarah LaDuke is our producer. Thanks also to Alan Chartok, Ian Pickus, Ray Graff, and to our engineer on the board, Dave Hopper. I want to thank you for joining us for the Roundtable as well. I'm Joe Donahue. Stay tuned now for Midday Magazine with Brian Shields.